Chapter 9. The Travelers. The use of traveling is to regulate imagination by reality, and instead of thinking how things may be, to see them as they are. Samuel Johnson. 1. Of the many descriptions of passage on the Ohio, few would surpass that by an American named Timothy Flint. A missionary and writer from Massachusetts, he started down the river with his wife and children on a perfect fall afternoon in 1816. "The autumns of every part of our country are beautiful," he wrote, "but those of the western country are preeminently so. Nothing resulting from beauty of sky, temperature of air, and charm of scenery can surpass what was now above us and around us." He wrote of the wide, clear sandbars that stretched for miles, the flocks of wild geese, swans, sandhill cranes, and pelicans stalking along them. The height and size of the corn was in itself alone a matter of astonishment. "There is something, too, in the gentle and almost imperceptible motion, as you sit on the deck of the boat and see the trees apparently moving by you, and new groups of scenery still opening upon your eye, together with the view of these ancient and magnificent forests, which the axe has not yet despoiled, the broad and beautiful river, the earth and the sky, which render such a trip at this season the very element of poetry." Many another expressed the same pleasure, including an increasing number of travelers from abroad, who had come for the specific purpose of seeing America. "Our passage down the river was extremely agreeable," reported one British writer, J.S. Buckingham, of his journey on the Ohio. "The weather was like the brightest English day in the middle of May, with a perfect calm, which made the surface of the stream like a mirror, in which were reflected the lofty hills on either side, with the occasional log cabins." Much that the travelers would see and experience was not to their liking, but the great river seldom proved a disappointment. Harriet Martineau, another English writer, who paid a long visit to the United States, described the experience of descending the Ohio as fully equal to her expectations. "And when we had put out into the middle of the river, we found ourselves in the way of a breeze, which enabled us to sit outside and enjoy the luxury of vision to the utmost. The sunny and shadowy hills, advancing and retiring, ribbed and crested with belts and clumps of gigantic beech, the rich bottoms always answering on the one shore to the group of hills on the other, a perfect level, smooth, rich, and green, with little settlements sprinkled over it. The shady creeks, very frequent between the hills, with sometimes a boat and figures under the trees which meet over it. These were the spectacles which succeeded each other before our untiring eyes." Even Frances Trollope, an aspiring English writer who was to become famous for her mockery and unabashed criticism of America and American ways, was openly moved by her first encounter with the Ohio River. "Truly does La Belle Rivière deserve its name. The Ohio is bright and clear. Its banks are continually varied as it flows through what is called a rolling country. The primeval forest still occupies a considerable portion of the ground and hangs in solemn grandeur from the cliffs. But it is broken by frequent settlements, where we were cheered by the sight of herds and flocks. And were there occasionally a ruined abbey or feudal castle, to mix the romance of real life with that of nature," she decided, "the Ohio would be perfect." Frances Trollope, a short, plump, plainly dressed Englishwoman in her 40s, arrived in America in 1827, accompanied by a son and two daughters, and chose to try life in Cincinnati. Pressed for a way to earn a living, she created an odd-looking public entertainment hall, or arcade. Partly Greek, partly Gothic Egyptian in architectural style, that included a theater, lecture rooms, coffee house, and bazaar. Trollope's Folly, as it became known, continued only to lose money. Eventually, she gave up and returned to England, there to write a travel book titled Domestic Manners of the Americans, that appeared in 1832 and became an immense success more than a decade before the works of another of her sons, Anthony Trollope, achieved his great fame. As for finding fault with Americans, their ways and outlook, she had no trouble. She deplored the reality of slavery and the way the sins of Jefferson with slave women were spoken about openly by all. She discounted the sacred American phrase, "All men are born free and equal," as no more than mischievous sophistry. J.S. Buckingham, who wrote no fewer than 8 volumes on his American experience, also expressed at the start his ardent opposition to slavery. He also thought Americans ate far too much, too fast, and had disgusting habits in the use of tobacco, namely constant spitting. If the condition of the average American worker was no better than that of the average English peasant, claimed Mrs. Trollope, that of his wife and daughters was worse, so hard was the life they led. It was rare, she claimed, to see an American woman reach the age of 30 without losing every trace of youth and beauty. She wrote, too, of the detestable mosquitoes and of feeling absolutely done in by how boring Americans could be. There is no charm, no grace in their conversation. I very seldom, during my whole stay in the country, heard a sentence elegantly turned and correctly pronounced. Perhaps, he thought, it was a result of how hard they worked, in the sense that all work and no play would make Jack a dull boy. Charles Dickens, when he arrived with his wife in America in 1842, had much the same reaction. "I am quite serious," he wrote, "when I say that I do not believe there are, on the whole earth besides, so many intensified bores as in these United States." Dickens was then not quite 30 years old, but already the author of half a dozen novels immensely popular at home, including The Pickwick Papers and Oliver Twist. As it had been for Mrs. Trollope, his steamboat, The Messenger, did not stop at Marietta, and so it was not to be part of the Western American experience for him. He was heading for Cincinnati and could hardly believe the company he was keeping. At mealtime, nobody said anything. "All the passengers are very dismal and seem to have tremendous secrets weighing on their minds. There is no conversation, no laughter, no cheerfulness, no society, except in spitting, and that is done in silent fellowship round the stove when the meal is over." The people were all alike. He found no diversity of character. All down the long table there is scarcely a man who is in anything different from his neighbor. J.S. Buckingham and Charles Dickens were both struck by the immense and lamentable difference between life on the northern and southern sides of the Ohio River. Buckingham saw in Kentucky the general absence of neatness and cleanliness, for the great bulk of laborers were Negro slaves, whose air, dress, and general appearance sufficiently manifested their indifference to everything but their own ease and their desire to escape from labor. Dickens said succinctly, "Where slavery sits brooding, there is an air of ruin and decay." Still another foreign traveler of note, Alexis de Tocqueville from France, who was to write one of the most brilliant studies of the American character, would conclude that if there were dark times ahead for the new country and its people, they would be brought about by the presence of slavery. They will owe their origin not to the equality, but to the inequality of condition. Another subject of continual fascination, puzzlement, and frequent amusement among the first-time visitors was the range and oddities of local expressions and vocabulary to be heard on all sides. Words like et for eight, yorn, hisn, and hern, for example, were part of everyday discourse, as were dunk for dip, fair to midland for fair, crick, creek, disremember, uncertain, or red up, tidy up, lollygaggin, tomcattin, and a chip off the old block. Dickens was particularly taken by the many duties served by the word fix. You call upon a gentleman in a country town, and his help informs you that he is fixing himself just now, by which you are to understand that he is dressing. You inquire on board of a steamboat of a fellow passenger whether breakfast will be ready soon, and he tells you he should think so, for when he was last below they were fixing the tables, in other words, laying the cloth. You beg a porter to collect your luggage, and he entreats you not to be uneasy, for he'll fix it presently. And if you complain of an indisposition, you are advised to have recourse to Dr. So-and-so, who will fix you in no time. Correct pronunciation, or too much fuss over diction, were ranked by local people in the same category as fancy dress and considered stuck up. Tall tales and practical jokes were much in favor. If asked by a stranger, "Where does this road go?" the local answer might be, "Don't go nowhere, mister. Stays right here." Like so many travelers, both foreign and American, Francis Trollope was astounded by the degree to which ardent spirits were consumed on all sides, and often to the most frightful excess. Whiskey, rum, peach brandy, hard cider, and mint juleps, all plentiful and cheap, had long been an accepted part of frontier life, as an essential to celebrations and ordinary camaraderie, as well as relief from physical pain, injuries, toothaches. Nor were those who consumed to excess a rarity, as everyone knew. The Philadelphia clergyman John A. Clark wrote of the free and unrestrained use of ardent spirits as fearfully prevalent on river travel especially. Usually on board these Western steamboats, whiskey is used just as freely as water. All drink. The pilot, the engineer, the fireman. All drink. The whiskey bottle is passed around several times a day, and then the dinner table is loaded with decanters. The plain truth, as one early chronicler of life in Ohio country, Henry Howe, would write, was that alcoholic liquids were long considered a necessity of life. Dr. Samuel Hildreth would write of the time when his physician father owned a tavern for a while, and of the large part drinking had played in the New England way of life. Cider, hard cider, he called the national beverage, and any farmer who furnished water in place of cider for his work hands was accounted a close-fisted, stingy man. While few farmers became drunkards, wrote the doctor, their red noses, blotched cheeks, and sore eyes betrayed the constitutional effect of their favorite beverage. In his research for his History of the Ohio Valley, Hildreth had come upon the journal of the young surveyor John Matthews, Rufus Putnam's nephew, who had been one of the original pioneers to land at Marietta in 1788, but had also taken part in an earlier surveying expedition in the valley in 1786, and in his journal provided a memorable description of the part alcohol could play on the frontier, as experienced during a night spent in one log cabin. Here I found a number of neighbors seated in social glee around a heap of corn. The inspiring juice of rye had enlivened their imaginations, and given their tongues such an exact balance that they moved with the greatest alacrity, while relating scenes of boxing, wrestling, hunting, etc. At dusk of evening, the corn was finished. Many of them took such hearty draughts of the generous liquor as quite deprived them of the use of their limbs. Some quarreled, some sang, and others laughed, while the whole displayed a scene more diverting than edifying. At 10 o'clock, all that could walk went home, but left 3 or 4 around the fire, hugging the whiskey bottle, and arguing very obstinately on religion, at which I left them and went to bed. Come morning, Matthews found those who had tarried all night still at their cups, and about 11 others came in to assist in drinking up what whiskey still remained. The scene Matthews witnessed, and so graphically described, wrote Samuel Hildreth, would lead one to conclude that great as was the need for surveyors in the West, was the need for those to rebuke the vices of the West, as it was in the older settled portions of the country near the Atlantic coast. The fact was, by then, the amount of drinking in the entire country had increased markedly. Consumption of hard liquor per capita by the 1820s had reached 5 gallons per year, the highest ever, and at that same time the temperance movement had gotten underway, a crusade against drunkenness that was taking hold everywhere, including the Ohio Valley. Charles Dickens found that even more distressing than the boredom of the company he had to endure on board the steamboat Messenger was the total absence of any ardent spirits. At dinner, he wrote, there is nothing to drink upon the table but great jugs full of cold water. Apparently, it depended on which boat you happened to be aboard. The temperance movement, too, had taken hold in Marietta and vicinity, and among its most earnest advocates was Ephraim Cutler. Having suffered the loss of his own alcoholic brother Charles, Ephraim well knew the extreme miseries excessive drinking could bring to a family. As his daughter Julia would write, he had banished all intoxicating drinks from his house and farm, and on the 4th of July as well, and in private and in public, urged others the propriety and necessity of total abstinence. For all that so many of the prominent travelers found fault with, there was also more than a little they did like, and for which they openly expressed approval. Dickens was astonished and delighted to find Cincinnati beautiful, cheerful, thriving, and animated. I have not often seen a place that commends itself so favorably and pleasantly to a stranger at first glance as this does. He found Cincinnatians intelligent, courteous, and agreeable, and, with good reason, were proud of their city. He was amazed to learn that the population had reached 50,000 and that the city was rightly famous for its free schools. By the time of his visit, in 1842, Cincinnati had become a great center for meatpacking, breweries, distilleries, boatworks, soap plants, shoe and beet factories. The population would steadily increase, due in substantial part to the thousands of immigrants arriving every year as a consequence, in good part, of the potato famine in Ireland and revolutions in Germany. From his hotel window, Dickens watched a temperance parade pass by and was particularly pleased to see the Irishmen in the march. They formed a distinct society among themselves and mustered very strong with their green scarves, carrying their national harp and their portrait of Father Matthew high above the people's heads. They looked as jolly and good-humored as ever, and working here the hardest for their living, and doing any kind of sturdy labor that came in their way, were the most independent fellows there, I thought. Dickens was also pleasantly surprised during his visit that no man sat down until the ladies were seated, or omitted any small act of politeness that would contribute to their comfort. Nor did I ever once, on any occasion, anywhere, during my rambles in America, see a woman exposed to the slightest act of rudeness, incivility, or even inattention. Harriet Martineau, too, thought the manners of Americans the best she ever saw, and show to their greatest advantage as to the gentleman in traveling. The presence of music in one form or other, and that of the fiddle in particular, was another part of American life at all levels with much appeal to many of the travelers, a number of whom were glad to join in. A well-traveled Englishman named Fortescue Cumming, who happened also to play the violin, was a notable early example. He crossed Ohio in 1807, and on a night spent in a farmhouse near Chillicothe, had to sit and listen to the farmer's sons as they scraped away without mercy on two shocking bad violins, one of which was of their own manufacture. But the next day, in threatening weather, he stopped at the home of an immigrant Irishman, whose daughter had married a young shoemaker named Irons. Cumming decided to linger to have his shoes mended and found a dozen of stout young fellows who had been at work repairing the road and were now sheltering themselves from the increasing storm and listening to some indifferent music made by their host on a tolerably good violin. I proposed taking the violin while he repaired my shoes. He consented and sat down to work, and in a few minutes I had all the lads jigging it on the floor merrily. Irons himself, as soon as he had repaired the shoes, jumping up and joining them. If there was a reality of American life that Francis Trollope, Charles Dickens, and others found most disgraceful and unacceptable, it was the removal of the native tribes to more remote reservations to the West, brought on by the members of Congress. If the American character may be judged by their conduct in this matter, wrote Mrs. Trollope, they are most lamentably deficient of every feeling of honor and integrity. It was impossible for any mind of common honesty not to be revolted by the contradictions in their principles and practice. Dickens encountered firsthand one of the last phases of the removal. It occurred in northeastern Ohio, still mostly wilderness, as he and his wife were heading by stagecoach toward Niagara and ultimately home to England. At Upper Sandusky, a Wyandotte village on Lake Erie, they stopped for the night. Upper Sandusky was one of about 16 locations where the tribes of Ohio, more than 2,000 Shawnee, Seneca, Delaware, Ottawa, and Wyandots, had been forced to remove as a result of the removal bill enacted in 1830. At breakfast the morning after his arrival, Dickens listened to the federal agent for the Wyandots, Colonel John Johnston, deliver a moving account of their strong attachment to the familiar scenes of their infancy, and in particular to the burial places of their kindred and of their great reluctance to leave them. We met some of these poor Indians afterwards, riding on shaggy ponies, Dickens continued. They looked to him like gypsies. Later that summer, the Wyandots departed for Cincinnati, where they were to go by steamboat to reservations farther west. They were the last of the natives to leave Ohio. Only the Indian names were to remain, names like Chippewa and Chillicothe and Cuyahoga, Ottawa, Muskingum, Sandusky, Scioto, and Seneca, as well as the name of the state and the great river. 2. In the spring of 1839, Samuel and Rhoda Hildreth decided that for them the time had come for travel in the opposite direction, back east to their home ground. 24 years had passed since Samuel had made his surprise appearance at his parents' doorstep in Massachusetts, while for Rhoda it had been more than 40 years since she had said goodbye to her Massachusetts home at age 10. Both were now in their 50s. Their children were nearly all grown. Their son, George, now 27, had become a doctor and still single, lived at home and worked as a partner with his father, and so he would look after the practice in his father's absence. Samuel and Rhoda would travel by a system of transportation unimaginable until then. by private carriage, river steamboat, canal boat, railroad car, and one ocean-going steamboat, covering in all some 1,700 miles round trip. The day of their departure by private carriage was Monday, May 6th, and as usual, Samuel was to keep a journal the whole way. Because he was to speak at a gathering in Cleveland, the convention of the Physicians' Society of Ohio, of which he was the president, they headed north, overland by carriage, to Zanesville, instead of taking the usual route back upstream on the Ohio. At Zanesville, they would stop overnight with their son Charles, who, like his father and grandfather and brother, had also become a doctor. The route to Zanesville was highly picturesque and much changed. The countryside had become well cultivated, whereas only a few years past it had been covered with dense forest. Samuel remembered riding 12 miles or more without seeing a clearing or cabin. Now, from an elevated ridge, the view reached as much as 20 miles to the horizon. From Zanesville, they moved on by steamboat on the Muskingum to a tiny town called Dresden, and there shipped on board a canal boat to Cleveland. The cost of passage, he dutifully recorded, was 5 cents a mile, or $7.50 total, to Cleveland. Cleveland was dazzling. If ever evidence was needed of Ohio's transformation, he felt, here it was. With its 8,000 or 10,000 inhabitants, and buildings equal in splendor to those of any other city of its size in America, its war of swarming with life, and the bustle of an active seaport. In the short space of 55 years, he wrote, the gloom and silence of the wilderness has given place to civilization, with the arts of agriculture and commerce which follow in its train. No fewer than 50 steamboats now navigated Lake Erie, he was told, and the lake itself he thought spectacular. To a person unacquainted with the grandeur of the sea, the first view of the lake has a sublime and imposing appearance. The wind blew strongly from the northeast, and heavy surf was breaking on the shore with all the tumult of the ocean. The white foam of the curling water, glancing on the sunbeams, were seen as far as the eye could reach. The lake was subject to sudden storms, he went on to explain. The calm, placid surface of a morning could turn into angry billows by midday, and navigation was considered more dangerous even than in storms on the Atlantic Ocean. The next day, being a Sunday, they attended church and rested from our labors. The day after was taken up touring the city, and the day following, May 14th, Samuel delivered his talk at the medical convention at Council Hall to a gathering of approximately 50 Ohio physicians. His subject was the diseases of Ohio and the history of medicine in the early settlements. As a naturalist, he also took particular pleasure in describing how, in 1788, the Ohio Company established one of the first settlements. One dense, continuous forest covered the whole region, and went on to recall the variety of giant trees. It was, in its way, his hymn to the vanished wonder of the wilderness, and to the natives for whom it had so long been their kingdom. He described, on the bottoms, or alluviums, and on the north sides of rich hills, the beech, sugar maple, ash, and elm were the prevailing growth, while the sycamore, Platanus occidentalis, lined the borders of the rivers, where its roots could be refreshed by the running water. Along these streams the red man pushed his light canoe, rejoicing in the wild freedom of the forest, and happily unconscious of the approaching fate which threatened his race, and was soon to banish all but his name from the face of the earth. At 9 the following morning, the travelers were on their way again, on board the steamboat Erie, heading east on the lake to Buffalo at an amazing 14 miles per hour. Arrived at the harbor of Erie at 7 p.m. We left Erie at 9 p.m. and arrived at Buffalo at 5 o'clock the next morning. Later in the morning, they went by rail to the village of Niagara. As we approached the falls, Hildreth wrote, the noise of many waters was heard in awful majesty. The spectacle of the falls was all that had been said of them. On Friday, May 17th, another short train ride to Lockport, New York, where they changed to a canal boat on the Erie Canal, which overnight carried them to Rochester. After another overnight on the canal, they arrived at Syracuse on May 19th, 4 days after departing Cleveland. It being another Sunday, they again rested and attended church. On reaching Utica by a canal the next day, they boarded a train to Albany, traveling part of the way at an unimaginable 30 miles an hour, or a mile in 2 minutes, a little like flying, Hildreth wrote. Then it was on to New York, on board another steamboat down the Hudson River past West Point, the view of which was very grand, past the majestic Palisades, landing at the city about 6 p.m., having run the distance of 160 miles in 11 hours, as Hildreth also noted with amazement. The U.S. hotel, where they stayed, was an immense 7 stories high, but the continual noise and confusion of the streets were also very striking and annoying to strangers, and especially to those from the backwoods. The next morning, Friday, May 24th, a very pleasant day, as Hildreth noted in his journal, they took passage on a steamboat named Splendid for New Haven, Connecticut. For Hildreth, the stop at New Haven figured as one of the highlights of his life. The chance to visit Yale, by then the largest university in the country, and one with a curriculum that included geology, chemistry, theology, art, and medicine, all that so mattered to him, meant worlds. Even more important, he would, at last, meet Benjamin Silliman. If he, Hildreth, ranked among the pioneers in American science at the time, Silliman, the Pathfinder, was the most prominent and influential scientific American during the first half of the 19th century. Important, too, to Hildreth, was the part Silliman had played in establishing the medical institution at Yale, at a time when only 5 medical schools existed in the United States. In addition to the articles Hildreth had been writing for the American Journal of Science, the first of the kind, a successful publication that Silliman had started in 1818, the two of them had been carrying on active correspondence for some time. Hildreth, reporting on the shells he had found by the Ohio River, or on the abundance of Isabella and Catawba grapes he was growing with great results. In 1835, after 6 years of intensive research and field management, Hildreth had written a major paper for the journal on bituminous coal deposits in the valley of the Ohio. It was a subject certain to appeal to Silliman, the first to teach geology at Yale or anywhere else in America, and who had since become the leader of American geology. The article was abundantly illustrated with a map, numerous drawings of plants and shells, and views of interesting scenery. In 1836, another treatise appeared in the journal, this titled 10 Days in Ohio, from the Diary of a Naturalist, which placed him among the nation's foremost geologists. He put forth a highly important theory, his belief that it had taken a vast period of time to hollow out the local valley between the hills, in which the Ohio now meanders, and to deposit that vast bed of alluvial earth which constitutes its present fertile and rich bottoms. In fact, as would be acknowledged by later-day geological scholars, Samuel Hildreth was the first American geologist to recognize the enormous amount of subaerial, on the surface of the earth, erosion that had taken place throughout the region, and that the Ohio River had carved out its own channel. Among those of his own time who immediately grasped the importance of what he had written and told him so was Benjamin Silliman. When the steamboat Splendid docked at New Haven that same day, the town of New Haven struck him immediately as one of the most beautiful he had ever seen. in its setting and the classic neatness of its buildings, but most of all its broad avenues lined with noble elms. No town in America, he decided, was so beautifully provided with shade trees. He wrote of the three imposing churches near the center of the common, and of the college buildings extending along the whole length of the back side of the common. At age 60, Benjamin Silliman was just 4 years older than Hildreth, and as would be said, richly endowed by nature physically as he was mentally, a man of striking appearance, tall, well-proportioned, handsome, and courteous. In his years at Yale, he put science on an equal to the arts, something no one had yet done, but also maintained an active interest in the arts. Professor Silliman greeted the Hildreths at their lodgings, and to start things off, he took them on a stroll through the lovely historic Grove Street Cemetery, just off the campus. "Death loses half its terrors," Hildreth wrote, "when we reflect that our bodies are to be laid quietly in such a beautiful spot." That evening was spent with Silliman, his wife, two daughters, and a son at their handsome home on Hillhouse Avenue, a street of many handsome homes. It was there that Hildreth found Silliman to be the most affable and good-humored of men. Also part of the family, much to Hildreth's surprise and delight, was the celebrated painter John Trumbull, who was Mrs. Silliman's uncle, then 86 and living with the family. A few years earlier, finding himself without ready means of support, Trumbull had offered to give Yale his collection of his work if Yale would grant him an annual income of $1,000 for the rest of his life. Silliman then succeeded in raising the money to build a Trumbull Gallery on campus, designed by Trumbull, the first art gallery on any campus in the country. Hildreth found Trumbull very interesting and enjoyed looking at a number of Trumbull paintings that decorated the Silliman parlor. He also spent a good part of the evening enraptured with Silliman's rare books on natural history. Seldom, if ever, had Hildreth been surrounded by so much that so intensely interested him. Silliman's private library filled a very large separate building attached to the house and was to Hildreth a perfect wonder. When the Sillimans invited the Hildreths to spend the rest of their time in New Haven as their guests, the Hildreths happily accepted. Most of the next day was spent touring the Yale campus, starting with the Trumbull Gallery, where among the many Trumbull masterpieces were his Declaration of Independence, Death of General Warren at the Battle of Bunker's Hill, and General Washington at the Battle of Trenton, as well as numerous miniature portraits, including one of Rufus Putnam. For Hildreth, who in his professional life had cared for so many veterans of the Revolution, and was himself an accomplished artist, to be seeing all this as he stood beside Trumbull himself could only have been an experience like no other. Further, he was greatly moved by the conditions Trumbull had insisted on in making the gift to Yale. "All the avails of the exhibitions of this gallery," Hildreth noted in his journal, "go to the support of indigent students in the college, so that the labors of his pencil will continue to bless and to charm mankind for ages after his death." From the gallery, the group moved on to the great Gibbs Cabinet of Minerals, the gift to Yale by a Colonel George Gibbs, who had collected some 10,000 species in Europe. Hildreth had not a doubt that he was looking at a collection superior to that of any other in America. Before the tour ended, it also included a stop to see a display of the anatomical collection at the medical college, and another of exceedingly rare and beautiful birds sent from China by a missionary. What Rhoda Hildreth thought of all this, and whether she stayed with the group the whole tour, unfortunately remains unknown. No letter or travel journal in her hand has survived. The day following, Sunday, May 26th, they attended church at the chapel of the college, where about 350 students were present, or most of the student body. That evening, as Hildreth was proud to record, he went with Silliman to pay his respects to the remarkable Noah Webster, the great lexicographer who had demanded there be an American language and who ranked high among Hildreth's heroes and lived nearby the Yale campus. "He is now 84 years old," Hildreth wrote in amazement, "but active in body and nearly as brilliant in mind as he ever was. I consider this man as first in American literature, and as having done more for the enduring fame of the country in letters than any other person." The next morning, May 27th, they were on their way again, this time by stagecoach to Hartford, and they would keep on the move for 2 months, visiting relatives, sisters, and brothers, old friends in Boston, museums, libraries, and historical societies. Samuel also took time to witness an operation performed at the Massachusetts Hospital and to examine the very extensive collections at the Boston Natural History Society. They traveled as far north as Portland, Maine, to visit a Hildreth sister, Harriet, and as far south in Massachusetts as Fairhaven, near New Bedford, where Rhoda Hildreth was born and raised. "My wife is highly gratified with the visit," wrote Samuel, "and recognizes many of the scenes of her childhood." On a visit to Methuen, his birthplace, they found the old family home much as he remembered it. "Examined with much interest the room in which I was born, and the one where I slept when a boy, for many years. Happy, happy days, never again to return." By the first week of July, the time had come to start the return to Ohio. There was a stop again in New York, with still more visits to libraries and museums, then a steamboat ride on the beautiful Delaware to Philadelphia for some final shopping, then on by railroad to Harrisburg, then on farther by canal boat. To cross the Allegheny Mountains, they traveled by a contrivance that hauled the canal boat up and over the mountains, something such as they never had experienced and that fascinated Hildreth. "Here we were drawn up an inclined plane by a stationary engine and a huge cable of hemp. This operation of drawing up is repeated 5 times by as many engines before reaching the summit. The mountain scenery at this season of the year is fine. The chestnut is in full bloom and very abundant." At the summit, there was a stop at a tavern for dinner. Then, the descent down the western slope of the range required the same number of inclined planes as the eastern side. Then they boarded a train for 5 hours, traveled 38 miles to the village of Johnstown, where travel on the canal boat resumed to Pittsburgh. From there on, as usual, the journey would continue on the Ohio. Pittsburgh, for all its commercial and manufacturing importance, did not much appeal. Pittsburgh is a very dirty, smoky town, especially on a rainy day. The streets are filthy and badly paved. Pittsburgh and New York, it would appear, were the only stops on the entire journey that Hildreth found not to his liking. Traveling on down the river on a steamboat called Excel was another matter. The trip on the Ohio that so charms so many newly arrived visitors from abroad, or Americans on their first time west, had much the same effect on the Hildreths on their return to home. They had been away for nearly 3 months, longer than they ever had or ever would again, and their joy in being back could not have been greater. "We found the family all well and rejoiced to see us again after so long an absence. Our hearts were rejoicing in the goodness of God, who has safely guided and protected us through the perils of the journey, suffering no accident or evil to befall us from the day of our departure to the day of our return." It would seem clear, too, that for all they had seen back east, all those they had met who were of such remarkable ability and accomplishment, nothing could compare to the time in New Haven. Months later, Hildreth would write to Benjamin Silliman, "We often think and speak of our delightful visit at New Haven, and especially of the kindness of yourself and family, which has made a deep impression on our hearts. By remarkable coincidence, while the Hildreths were on their Eastern pilgrimage, a traveler from Boston stopped for the first time at Marietta and, much taken by what he saw, wrote one of the most enthusiastic descriptions ever of the town in a letter that appeared first in the Boston Mercantile Journal and later in the Marietta Intelligencer. He was Amasa Walker, a Boston businessman, economist, and future congressman. Let no New England man ever visit the Valley of the Ohio without stopping at least one day in Marietta. It will do his heart good. He will find it a charming town, so like the beautiful valleys of his own native land, that he will feel perfectly happy and at home. We had no business at this place, and should not have stopped. But that Saturday night found us opposite the town, and as we do not travel on the Sabbath, we went on shore and took lodgings. This is the spot where the settlement of Ohio commenced in 1788. Here, 51 years ago, General Rufus Putnam, with his followers, landed and began to clear and build, and now Ohio contains almost 1.5 million of inhabitants. He explained how the town, located on the rich bottomland at the junction of the Ohio and the Muskingum, was laid out with great regularity. He said, "The buildings, a large proportion of which are brick, are handsome and in finer order than any I have seen on the river," and that there were several churches, a courthouse, and other public buildings, as were a newly erected college, the president of which was a truly excellent man, the Reverend Joel Harvey Lindsley, lately of the Park Street Church in Boston. Few places offer more instructive lessons than Marietta. Here we can see what half a century will effect in the West. The Ohio and Muskingum flow on as they did when Putnam landed, but all else how changed. The maturity of this place is the most striking feature. Here are found all that we witness in the old settlements on the Atlantic, the same institutions, the same architecture, and the same general habits. The order and quiet of the place are worthy of note. The Sabbath has passed as silently as in the most rural hamlet in the land of the pilgrims. In passing around the town, I have noticed none of those low grog shops, which are the curse of almost all the western towns, and I have neither seen nor heard anything like intemperance and riot. If the speculator on the abstract doctrine of political economy and the progress of population wishes for a practical illustration of what has been done and is now doing at the West, let him visit this spot, and he will be astonished, perhaps confounded. He will see that already accomplished which in Europe would require centuries, society in a high state of perfection, institutions established on a firm basis, and everything moving on in harmony and prosperity. Marietta cannot, it is true, vie with Cincinnati and some other towns in population. But there is a quiet elegance and beauty in the place that no other which I have seen in this region can boast.